Hi, this is Jeff Patterson, and this is another episode of the Three Horsemen podcast. And once again, I am joined by my two fellow horsemen who are riding through the dark and misty nights as autumn descends upon us. Let's say hello to everybody. Hello, Mr. John Stevens.
Hello. I am here. I am John Stevens. I'm a writer. I'm an SF Signal regular columnist. I am a person who does lots of different things online, and currently writing a couple of books, and that's about it right now.
Good. That's enough. That's a busy life. You can be proud of that. And also joining us, as always, is the charming and lovely Fred Kish.
And now I'm wondering why it's gone from one book to a couple of books, but we'll get into that later, I'm sure. Good evening, everyone. This is Fred Kish. I blog at Bernal Alpha, B-E-R-N-A-L-A-L-F-A-A, or P-H-A, sorry. It's been a long day. And I can usually be found at Fred Kish on Twitter, where I will endlessly entice you with 140 characters.
And I, as some of you probably know, can be found on Twitter as JeffPatterson11, and I blog at Gravity Lens, which can be found at baddaystudio.com. It's been a little while since we got together. It's been slightly over a month. The last podcast of ours that went up was right before WorldCon. And oh, what a month it's been since that last one. The theme that's been running through my mind as we approach this was life getting in the way of fandom, which certainly has. As school gets back in session and we all deal with the seasons changing, etc. Things have been interesting, but right after that podcast aired, I went on my first vacation in quite a long time. Which was a road trip ending quite climactically at WorldCon in San Antonio. And it was a interesting trip. We drove. Enterprise Rent-A-Car deemed it adequate to give me a Dodge Charger, a 2013 Dodge Charger, which thinking about the gas pedal would put it into very, very high velocity while traveling through the great highways of the American South. Fortunately, I had about 40 hours or so of really good tunes that I put together for the trip, and that certainly helped. We also got to listen to a lot of local radio. As we were traveling. We were driving back on a Tuesday, and no matter throughout four different states that we traveled through, it was always two for Tuesday, no matter what classic rock radio station you were listening to. We hit Pigeon Forge and Gatlinburg, Tennessee, which were both quite nice in a very strange, artificial, touristy way. And then we went down to New Orleans for a couple nights. And it was the first time I had been down there since Katrina, and I was very happy to see that it was pretty much the same as it's always been. A little bit of weird civic engineering stuff going on in the downtown area, but it was quite fun. Hit a lot of antique shops and stuff like that. And then we struck west across the great nothing to San Antonio. It's very weird because for hours and hours you are driving through on elevated roads over actual bayous and swamps. And then suddenly you hit Houston and, you know, reality kicks in again. WorldCon itself was enjoyable for me. This was my first one that I had gone to Montreal was the last one I went to? Yeah, Montreal was my last one. The high point, of course, was running into everybody. I got to meet Mr. DiNardo and Hester for the first time, as well as J.P. France and Karen Burnham, and spent a lot of time with Matthew Sanborn Smith. He actually put up with me as I regaled him with elderly memories of WorldCon's past during the little display they had there. Got to see Jamie Todd Rubin. Third time I've met him. Never in the state that we both live in. yeah, he's 20 miles away from me, and we have to travel half the country to see each other.
Welcome to the future.
Yeah, spent a big chunk of time with Derek Johnson on Sunday, which was a lot of fun. Larry Ketcher said, met Josh Voigt, but did not get to speak to him all that much, which is something I was very unhappy with. Autographs all over the place. Mr. Jess Nevins autographed a bunch of my annotations of League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, which made me happy. Finally got to meet David Levine, who I had never met. Patrick, of course, who just name drops and everybody who walks by says hi to him. Introduced me to people like Irene Gallo and Galen Dara the day before she won the Hugo. And we had the big SF Signal breakfast and got to meet Stina finally and had a nice little run-in with David Brin at the elevators and got autographs from Joe Lansdale and a few others, which made me happy. I did have art on display in the print shop, and I also had art for sale during Artist Alley. I sold a bunch of holiday cards, but nobody bought any prints. I'm not exactly certain what message to take away from that. And
people are cheap.
Yeah. Well, so was most of my prints, to be honest with you. But the cards did go well. I was actually kind of surprised because they were almost an afterthought. So this is the first WorldCon I'd ever attempted to do art for. The convention was sharing the convention center with the People Magazine Espanol Expo. We had about 4,000 attendees. They had about, I'm going to guess, 10,000 attendees. Uh-huh. And Gloria Estefan gave a concert there, and all kinds of stuff was going on. Between that and the holiday weekend, one of the things that I found not disconcerting, but slightly disappointing, was that Sunday, while we were down there, was my birthday, and my wife wanted to take me out to dinner, and we could not find a restaurant table anywhere. And so we ended up eating snack food in our hotel room for my dinner. I ended up describing downtown San Antonio on Labor Day weekend with 14,000 aliens all in the convention center all at once is a much prettier version of Soylent Green. It was it was very, very crowded, but my God, it was gorgeous to walk through there. Everybody down there was great. The hotel, there was apparently there's a shortage of refrigerator technology in hotel rooms in San Antonio, but they were very nice, and they accommodated us as much as they could. But yes, it was much fun, obviously far too short. I went to the SF Signal gathering and got to meet quite a few folks, but not nearly everybody. But as always, it was quite exhausting and great fun to be had by all. And I missed both of you guys there. So
I still need to know why the eggs ended up on the ceiling.
Why the eggs ended up on the ceiling?
That's what Mr. Matthew Sanborn Smith said. Something about eggs and syrup on the ceiling.
Well, I
Maybe
know
he was
that
joking.
He. I know. I'm pretty certain he's joking, but I know that the the breakfast.
Pretty
that,
certain. Huh?
The breakfast that we had, we did. I think they mentioned this on the SF Signal podcast too. We did kind of drive the waitress slightly nuts, and I think Matthew was out to make the waitress hate him. Honestly, sincerely, to the core, hate him. I'm not positive. I could be wrong on this. But yes, people kept coming in and being added. And of course, by the time Derek had gone over first and got us all a table, and we're so grateful that he did, because by the time we were done, there had to be a line of 40 people out the front door of a Denny's. So
wow,
that just shows you how crazy it was. But yeah, it was a good time. It actually, you know, aligned my fandom chakras, I guess. You know, once in a while I need a bit of a booster shot to to remind me what's going on. I really didn't get to enjoy the con as much as I wanted to between doing the art stuff and doing the gatherings and stuff like that. I really didn't hit a lot of panels. Spent a lot of time in the dealer's room primarily looking at things because I was very impressed with the actual variety of goods that were on sale this time around. Something I didn't take away from Montreal, but you know, that's, I know it's tough for dealers to get stuff up there for selling, but yeah, it was a good time. And then we had a nice, we had a two day ride home through the south, through the strange looking semi retro futuristic cities of Memphis and Nashville and Knoxville with the old World's Fair ruins that are still there and stuff like that. So the whole thing had a bit of a vibe, a bit of a theme as the trip went on, but quite enjoyable. Don't want to do another lengthy road trip anytime soon. Go aim for some shorter ones next time, but it was quite good, and hope to meet everybody who I met there again. So, we have been talking a lot on Twitter, back and forth, about a number of subjects.
And email,
about things we wanted to talk about. We were going to do some book-centric ones, but as I said, life gets in the way of fandom. Hopefully things are somewhat stable now, and we do plan on doing that in future episodes. But, Fred, I know you have been talking about some books that you have been diving into and some stuff that you have been finding online. Why don't you tell us about that?
Okay, well, I finished the Fritz Leiber book that I had mentioned last month, Ghostlight, and in fact pretty much read it twice, or read it once as words and listened to it once almost as an audiobook from Audible, which was an interesting experience because each story was read by a different narrator. So it was, and they picked quite a number of people that really seemed to fit the stories. So that was enjoyable. And I think we heard one of the stories, Four Ghosts in Hamlet. I think I've heard it now four times audibly because my daughter was in the production of Hamlet.
Ah.
So I had to play it for her, then I played it for my wife, and I listened to it twice. So I am Hamleted out. But the last part of that book is a long autobiographical essay by Leiber where you can see where he got a lot of his ideas and his experiences that fed into the various stories. So that was also very enjoyable to pick that apart. Other things... Harlan Ellison has joined the 20th century and now has his own YouTube channel. And we will, of course, put links in the show notes. What I found really interesting in this is he did, years ago, when sci-fi spelled their name differently, and actually had a talk show, he did a series of vignettes for them, about 5 minutes long each, where he talked about various authors or talked about women in science fiction or talked about art or talked about the Wizard of Oz, all sorts of... I think they've now posted 23 of those short talks. So I've been really enjoying watching that again.
I remember he vented about the death of Superman.
They haven't posted that one yet.
And I think the advertising of the last action hero on the side of some unmanned rocket that was sent into orbit, too.
Yep. But it makes you wonder why sci-fi doesn't even have just a half-hour weekly show where they talk about, gosh, science fiction, fantasy, books, podcasts, radio, I mean, movies. It just seems to be such a lost opportunity there. Other things I've been reading, I have finished a book called Benchmarks by a man named Algis Budrys, from 1965 to 1971, he wrote reviews for Galaxy magazine while that was around, and then eventually moved to fantasy and science fiction. So, and that was all three of the books falling off the table. But the first volume was published by Southern Illinois University Press, and I started reading it when it was mentioned on, I believe, the Coon Street podcast. And then Dave Langford, who does the online fanzine Ansible, he has a publishing arm, and he's come out with three installments since then. Now, what's kind of odd is that the original book ends in 1971, but the first Langford book starts in 1975. So I'm not sure what happened between the rest of 1971 and the beginning of 1975 as far as columns. What I'm finding really interesting about these columns is he often does not even talk about the book he reviews. He'll talk about personalities. He'll talk about the marketing. He castigated this small press once, which sent copies at the expense of the authors to various reviewers. And he said, look, none of us review these books. None of us want to review these books. You're just throwing your clients' money down a rat hole by sending us these books. And he'll often start out panning a book but praising the author or vice versa. So it's an interesting series of reviews.
Hmm.
The young Delaney, the young Zelazny, the young Russ, the older Heinlein or Clark. Everybody gets a shot in here at one point or the other.
Wow.
So wow. Highly recommend them. And in the mail this week from Irene Gallo, speaking of tour books, I received an advance uncorrected proof of a book called What Makes This Book So Great by Jo Walton, she of the last year's Hugo-winning novel. And this is a collection of her essays that have appeared at the tour.com site, which I'm enjoying with one caveat, the caveat being that I wish she had just expanded these things a little bit more than just taking them right from the site, because she'll talk about a book which kind of works on a website because you're just dipping in briefly, but in a book like this, you'd like to get some background or additional information about whatever author she's talking about. And you also don't get the advantage of the website being that you don't see the comments and the questions and her responses, etc. So that's been my month, gentlemen.
Wow. That's you got me kind of pining for both of those. I really want to check that out.
Yeah, the Budrys is excellent. Those are excellent.
What's the title of the Budrys again?
The first one is called Benchmarks, and then it's Benchmarks Continued is the next series. And I have all links to all of them will be available on the show notes. The continuation collections can only be ordered right now directly from Dave Langford in paper, but he has said that ebook versions will come.
Wow. Awesome. Yeah. I like that. John, what have you been up to?
It was interesting. It was so much. But it was interesting to hear Fred talk about Joe Walton's book, because I'm actually working on a book of my own columns, like a best of for publication. And what you're talking about, that need to sort of look at the essays again and contextualize them because they're being presented outside of the internet, is really, I think, a crucial thing to do when you transition books like that. I'm very curious to read the book and see how looking at all those essays in that condensed format work, but...
Well, I'll send it to you as soon as I'm done with it.
Cool. But I think you're right that books like that often would benefit from expansion of some of the essays, or at least somewhat more contextualization of them, because a lot of essays written for the internet are written very, very much for the moment. And when you take them out and try to put them in a format like that, you really need to look at them and see which ones essentially stand the test of time and on their own, and which ones need some expansion or focus or additions in order to bring out fully what you're trying to do with the essay.
I mean, imagine if somebody took their tweets and put them in an ebook.
Oh, what a dumb idea that would.
What kind of hack would do that?
And then misspell their friend's name.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Okay. Lord. Only a barbarian. So.
Clearly. But I've been working on that, and I'm working on some other stuff too. But I've been trying to work through my stack of review books, and I'm actually kind of behind on getting reviews out, and that's one of the projects I'm going to have now that my daughter is going to be away for several weeks. I'm going to try to catch up on a lot of writing. The two things I want to talk about tonight were a couple of books. One I am going to write a review for, but I want to talk a little bit about, and then a couple that I wasn't going to write reviews of that I've read recently that I want to talk about. And then I also want to say a little bit about, invoking my daughter, some graphic novels that she and I have been reading together that are interesting. So the two books I want to talk about, or three. One is nonfiction, and that's the relatively latest Ray Bradbury, which is Becoming Ray Bradbury. And this is a book that I think in some ways may be the best Ray Bradbury literary biography to come out yet.
Saying a lot.
It is. But in other ways, there are things I wanted from it that I didn't get. And to try to tackle both of those things at once. What's great about it is I don't think there's actually been such a detailed study of Bradbury's early years. This covers sort of Bradbury's formative period from basically high school when he first started writing seriously to basically the point where he finally becomes, the person known as Ray Bradbury when he starts publishing his novels and really breaks out of the science fiction literary field into the larger literary field. And what's so great about the book is that level of detail. You see so much. I was trying to compare it to, there's another biography that came out several years ago that someone actually tweeted about today as being new, and I actually went on and said, oh, it's not actually new, it's been out for a while. That is much more, it came out in 2005. But the Kindle edition just came out, so it looks new. Because whenever you go to a Kindle heading, Amazon is just so lazy, they rarely actually put the original pub date.
Right.
And it's the pub date of the Kindle book, and people are like, oh, this new book came out. And you have to go and say, well, actually.
Yeah, you caught me on that a couple weeks ago.
Right, with Carl Friedman's book, right?
Right, yeah.
On critical theory and science fiction, yeah. I really wish they wouldn't do that, but, they probably don't care. So. What's great about this book, and I actually urge people to read this in a recent Mind Meld too, and then someone got on the Mind Meld comments and were like, oh, it's not a fiction book, blah, blah, blah. But what's great about this book is you learn so much about what Bradbury did to build his career. All the dumb things he did, all the failed things he did, all the smart things he did. And you really get a very clear picture of his struggles in a way that's different than, I can't remember the name of this other Bradbury book. That's more like a memoir, like an oral memoir with combined information from other sources. It was a much more sort of journalistic biography. Whereas this one by Jonathan Eller is much more academic, but another thing that's great about it is it's not academic in the, dry, theoretical, rarefied intellectual sense. It's academic in its attempt to be very thorough by presenting all the information that seems relevant to the author about the person whose work he's talking about. And that's the great thing about it. Where I thought it fell down was that it's really hard to not beatify Bradbury. And everything I've ever read about Bradbury, I have yet to read a really, not even harsh, but nuanced critical view of his work. And while this book does a good job of sort of showing the things that he didn't do right, the stumbles he made, the inevitability of his ascension really does read like a beatification. There's definitely this element of hagiography. And like I said, I think that's hard to get away from with Bradbury because of how famous he became, but also because the type of writing that he generally wrote really affected so many readers deeply, that it's hard for thing for people to pull back and really try to get a different perspective on his writing. So you kind of, after a while, kind of go, yeah, he's great. Or, you know, he'll talk about a trend in Bradbury's work as if the trend that eventually came out years later was somehow hidden back in the stuff he did before. The thing that was intriguing to me was looking at some of the things Bradbury wrote and did. It didn't seem that inevitable. And I'd be really interested in seeing someone try to actually tackle that material, his early writing, and really look at it really carefully and see what may have been carried forward and what may have been left behind. So that's one book. And I'm going to write a longer review of that for SF Signal fairly shortly. The two fiction books I want to talk about were Brian Catling's The Vor and Seb Dubinsky's Song of Synth and Absinthe, which are both terrific books. They're both very quote-unquote literary books. And they're both really stretching the boundaries of imagination. I was quite taken for somewhat different reasons with both books. Catling is sort of a 21st century Robert Holdstock in some ways. He's writing these very fantastical narratives. He's braiding in all kinds of different references and ideas. And it's very, the language is very poetic. The language is very, it's just very carefully constructed, and it's also very evocative language.
Do you mean 21st century in the settings of the stories, or just a more modern version of?
Just sort of a more, like, he's sort of taken the next step that Holdstock might have taken if he was still writing today.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. I will make that assertion, and I'll see if people beat me up. It's really, in some ways, it's very mind-blowing stuff. There are little missteps here and there. But the sort of force of the narrative, the flow of the narrative, really picks you up and pulls you in. And it's not that sort of sense of transport to another world kind of thing, so much as sort of marveling at this fantastic word structure being built and played out before you. So it's really strong stuff. And I don't think the book got a little bit of attention when it came out, partly because Alan Moore wrote an introduction to it. But it really should be more widely read and discussed, I think. And then the other fiction was book of fiction I read. This is also going to be something I'm going to review for SF Signal, is Seb Dubinsky's Song of Synth and Absinthe. Dubinsky has kind of become one of my favorite writers in the last few years. And, you know, in sort of interest of full disclosure, where we're sort of corresponding friends, and he's published some of my work in one of his magazines. But he is, he's a European writer. He is, of French descent. He spent a lot of time in the US, so he's multilingual, but his English is impeccable. His writing English is certainly impeccable. And he tends to write these books that are, on one level, very trippy novels that try to take sort of the step into the day after tomorrow, sort of very much sort of near future-y stuff. But he's also very interested in getting into people's heads and trying to figure out what they can do to mess them up and simultaneously achieve some form of insight into their lives. So it's really cool in that respect. And what I like about this book in particular is that the device he uses to get into people's heads is this drug called synth that can basically create alternate realities in your mind. And that combination of very well-done writing with very interesting attempts to get deeply into people's heads. It was, for me, a very powerful mix. I mean, in a lot of books that sort of do these head trip things, the people aren't very well constructed, the characters. But what I think sets a lot of DaVinci's work off from these other folks is he's very interested in creating characters that are, that may be weird or odd or a little alien to us, but are people. So they're hesitant, they're aching, they get caught off guard by things. You know, they're always trying to fumble towards getting the next, you know, part of their lives done. Get through the next day, get through their job, get through the current crisis, et cetera, et cetera. And they're really impressive as imaginative literature, but also as sort of character studies of society. So it's really cool stuff.
Wow.
Yeah. So I haven't been reading much, very much light material recently.
You always make me spend money, you know?
Yep.
Damn it.
And then we go out and we make other people spend money.
Yeah. it rolls downhill from here. So.
It does. Yes, it does. And then the other thing I want to talk about that I had suggested to you guys earlier was my daughter, who's 4.5 years old, and I do a huge amount of reading together. Surprise, surprise. But recently, what she's become interested in is actually graphic novels. Mm-hmm. So I've been trying to find graphic novels, actual graphic novels. Like, she likes picture books, but she's intensely interested in progression of, you know, frames, progression of panels, progression of action.
And sequential art?
How old?
Yes, sequential art. She's 4.5.
Okay.
She's far too smart. She's far too intelligent, I can assure you. It's great, but it's also a challenge sometimes. So I've been trying to find stuff that I can read with her that's like that. And the two things I've come across that we've been reading recently are Ben Hakke's Zita the Space Girl, of which there are now 2 volumes. Zita the Space Girl, and then Legends of Zita the Space Girl. And then the other thing we've been reading, we've read the first 3 volumes of Kazu Kibuishi's Amulet series. So Zita the Space Girl is about Zita the Space Girl. It's about a young girl who gets pulled into another part of the galaxy with her best friend, who she then has to save because she kind of made him get teleported to the other side of the galaxy, and it's her responsibility to get him home again. So this is about her attempts to do that. In the process, she becomes this renowned hero in this other part of the galaxy, and has to deal with the effects of that fame on her and the expectations people have for her as sort of a galactic hero. And she's, you know, she's like a 10 or 11-year-old girl. So the art is fantastic. The art is absolutely...
Yeah, I've seen it online. It looks really good.
It's wonderful. One of the links I'm going to provide actually has a book trailer for the first volume. And the artwork is fantastic. It's, you know, it's great for everybody to look at as an example of cartooning. But I think for my daughter, what she gets caught up on are the facial expressions. Even the weirdest looking alien has a facial expression she can recognize. And that's part of how Hakke pulls you into, I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right, I hope I am. And if not, and you're hearing this, I apologize. But those facial expressions really pull you in. To the characters, and you can engage them even when they look totally inhuman. So she is really digging that. And I'm liking it too, although story-wise and progression of narrative-wise, there are a number of stumbles. And the second volume I had hoped would be better than the first in that regard, and it's really not. There are just moments where you feel there's a panel that you missed, or someone sort of said something to fill in this gap or that gap. But overall, it's a lot of fun to read, and it's definitely a real pleasure to view. And then the other thing that we started reading, and I was hesitant because this is sort of more of a, I think it's almost more of a middle school level book, is the Amulet series by Kibuishi. There are now 5 volumes, and we've read the first 3. And that is a more complex kind of tale. It's also about a young girl whose name is Emily, who finds out that she is the descendant of a very famous person in an alternate reality, who is what's called a stonekeeper, someone who can control powerful relics, magical relics. And it's about her basically trying to protect her family and figure out how they can get through this strange world they've been sent to. And that story is definitely more intricate than the Zeta story. The Zeta story has a very small cast of characters. It's almost always focused on Zeta herself, whereas the Amulet has a much broader story. The world is much wider. There's more sort of world building in it, in the fantasy sense. It's a vaguely steampunkish world where there are evil elves and good robots who are trying. She has a bunch of good robots who help her, and she's kind of being hunted by this evil elf king whose son is sort of sometimes her ally, sometimes her enemy. And there's a coming of age aspect to it, but it's really much more about this grand sort of fantasy story than the more focused sort of character study that Zeta is. But it's good. The art is also quite good. I like the Zeta art a little better because it's a little more dynamic. And the colors in Amulet are often darker, and that tends to mute the artwork a little bit. But the story, I think, is better written. And while it is kind of complicated in some ways, my daughter definitely gets the story, the basics of the story. She asks a lot of questions, but I think she gets it, and it's really fun for both of us to read.
I read those with my daughter, but we only, at that point, it was only the first three.
Okay.
And I just recently noticed that the other two had come out, so we're definitely going to have to catch up on it.
Yeah. Did you guys like it?
Oh, yes. That's one of her favorites.
Oh, nice.
And that led eventually to a lot of manga, which I hesitate to suggest various titles to you because you'll be in the same sinking financial trap that I'm in. But I will look at her shelves and see if I can think of any other books.
Great.
The two that I can think of offhand, but these you'd probably have to read to her. There's one series called The Guardians of Ga'Hoole, which is about owls.
We have to read that because she has seen the movie several times.
Right, okay. And then there's the Warrior series, which is about cats. And again,
By Aaron Hunter.
Yeah, they're both kind of, Watershipy Downy, kind of more than... So both of those sustained us for many summers.
Okay, great.
Wow.
Yeah, actually, the Warriors I knew about because we are constantly selling them in our store.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's manga, so you could start with that. And there's
Great, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, there's several sub-series at various levels, so it's might be worth looking at.
Okay.
That sounds neat.
Great.
I haven't read any real kid stuff in a while.
There's a reason for that, Jeff.
Yeah, I know.
Besides your age.
Yeah. One thing that I did want to mention, one of the earlier podcasts that we had done, Fred had discussed with great praise Glenn Cook's Garrett P.I. novels.
Yes.
And yep. While we were on our road trip, while we were in Pigeon Forge, we found a place which was the Book Warehouse / Moon Pie Emporium, which had a pretty amazing book selection. And amongst the books that I found there were a couple volumes of the Garrett P.I.'s, Cold Copper Tears and Dread Grass Shadows. Both of which I picked up and read, and yes, Fred, you were spot on with your reviews. They are quite nice, and there is a really sort of quiet genius to the way he plates these genres together during the course of the stories. And the other thing that really struck me was the Tim Hildebrand covers. I had never seen these before.
Right.
And they're quite remarkable. I want to see if I can find some larger versions of them. So yes, those were very good. One other book that I totally forgot about till I saw it sitting here on my desk while we were recording. Recently finished Borrowed Tides by Paul Levinson, which I had never read, even though I've read a lot of his short stuff. And a remarkable book about preparing for an interstellar voyage and trying to find some odd ways to achieve it. And very, very scientific with a little bit of mysticism thrown in. It's got some very equal measures of optimism and pessimism when it comes to trying to achieve progress and stuff like that. And highly recommended. 91, I think this came out. Oh, no, I'm sorry, 2001. It's a much more recent book. 2001, yeah, okay. Yeah, Glenn Cook, Garrett P.I., Borrowed Tides by Paul Levinson. And the other thing that's kind of been stirring in my brain lately, and I'm not certain exactly how I feel about it yet because we're still kind of mid-story. Currently, right now in Marvel Comics, they have what's called a crossover event, which basically consists of one limited series which carries the main meat of the story, and it tends to spill over into various tie-ins, usually in existing ongoing series. And both DC and Marvel do this quite a bit. And Marvel's got one going right now called Infinity, which has been kind of masterminded by Jonathan Hickman, who's been writing Avengers for a while now, coming up on a year, I think. And normally when Marvel does a big crossover event, it tends to be very widescreen and have lots of action. And quite often it has a lot of science fiction elements to it. This one is, and it's still going on, which is one of the reasons why I'm a little hesitant about it, but there's some parts of it I've really been enjoying. The story involves Thanos, the great big villain Thanos from the Marvel Universe, who has gotten together a posse called the Black Order of various ne'er-do-wells, and they have come to Earth trying to find Thanos' son, who is a character who we've never heard of before. That part of the story is not interesting me all that much. The part that is, the reason that Thanos has come to Earth now is because most of the Avengers are out in space. And the reason that they're out in space is because there is this wave of destruction that is being caused by a race called the Builders. And what separates this particular story from a lot of the other big science fiction epics that Marvel has tried to do in the past is the fact that Hickman has a pretty good understanding of science fiction, especially contemporary science fiction, and just doesn't throw out your typical empires and stuff like that. And in the course of this story, there's a lot of all the other different alien races that we've seen in the Marvel Universe are kind of all sort of meeting behind our back and going, you know, Earth is kind of a problem. And they're sort of ruling the Earth as kind of expendable in the greater picture. And as a result, this particular aspect of the story, the actual interstellar space opera part of it, is really kind of, you know, hitting the same chords as a lot of Peter Hamilton and S. Andrew Swan and stuff like that. It's got a very, you know, creepy yet very expansive vibe to it, and the stakes appear to be quite high. Now it's still not hitting on all cylinders, but it's one of those things where I'm kind of compelled to see where they're going to go with it, and they're not just pulling, you know, mystic mumbo jumbo out of their hats. Not to say that there isn't some mystic mumbo jumbo that takes place in the course of the story. This has been tying in with stuff that's been going on elsewhere in the Marvel Universe, the Avengers, and this little secretive group called the Illuminati, which is had included Francis Xavier, but Reed Richards and Tony Stark and these guys who kind of meet to sort of secure humanity's place and sort of future-proof the Earth and stuff like that, which is a conceit that was introduced, oh God, a few years back, and that I've really never really cared for. But Hickman's kind of using it rather well. And the other thing that he's doing is he's kind of introducing a lot of backbench characters that have sort of existed in the Marvel Universe that never really got to shine. I mean, he's got all the big name Avengers in there and stuff like that. But he's also got Hyperion and Gateway, who used to be an X-Men back in the awful 90s. And there's a big storyline involving the Inhumans and stuff like that. I don't want to say it's convoluted, but there are a lot of threads to it, which sort of in itself sort of stands it apart from a lot of other things they've done. The only other big crossover that I can think that Marvel did that sort of is on par with this was when they did the Age of Apocalypse stories, which was a parallel universe story. God, I think that's like 15 years ago now. But I mean, so far they've thrown macro engineering at you, and they've thrown this kind of industrialized panspermia network that's been going on in the universe for millions of years. And that sort of also brings me to the part that's kind of giving me a little bit of pause with this, is the fact that they're introducing a lot of stuff that we've never heard of before, which is not in and of itself bad, but the Marvel Universe is 50 years old and it drags so much baggage through it. And when you introduce a new character, that's one thing. When you introduce a new universe-spanning threat that apparently has been around forever, you know, it's kind of difficult to justify that given the amount of continuity. You know, but once again, we're talking about comics, so I let that slide to a bit. But this particular story I'm finding very compelling. There's parts of it I really like, parts of it that I go, okay, get past this so we can move on to the really cool space stuff. But it's different. It's got a different aesthetic to the art than it normally does. It's got a very painted feel. And the interaction of the characters, especially when they bring in groups like Guardians of the Galaxy and Nova and stuff like that, it's got an odd little dynamic. The last time they did a big cosmic saga was back when Dan Abnett was writing a lot of the cosmic stuff a while ago, and that stuff was really good. But this is different. I'm not going to say it's better or worse, but at the moment it's primarily different, and we'll see what happens when the story plays out. And I think 3 more months we got to go on it. So that's basically been my it's like 4 or 5 books a week I've been trying to consume on that. So anything else you boys been consuming that you've been enjoying lately?
Lots of podcasts.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, one that I've listened to for a while that seems to have popped up with a lot of people is a podcast called Night Vale.
Mm-hmm.
So if you like The X-Files or Fringe or Lovecraft or... I could go on and on. You might want to look that up.
I've seen a lot of people talking about it. Yeah, I have to go check it out because I am. It sounds right up my alley, actually.
Yep.
I've been listening to Zachary Jernigan's Hyperbolism.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's done 5 of them now. He's trying to do them weekly. For those that don't know who Zachary Jernigan is, he's a relatively new author. His first novel came out right at the tail end of Nightshade's collapse transformation, however you want to characterize it. a novel called No Return, which I'm also in the process of reviewing, and which I liked a lot, actually, I should say. It's interesting because it's short. It's usually like 10 to 20 minutes. It's just him talking about different things. He actually talked about Nightshade last time, and his take on the Nightshade debacle / opportunity, depending on how you want to characterize it. It's interesting to listen to because he definitely has a very distinctive perspective on things that you don't always get from other people. And he goes out of his way to be even-handed, which seems like a good idea. And actually, he's got a very, actually very good, like technically very good delivery. He writes them out beforehand, which seems odd to me because I don't think I've ever been on a podcast where I had planned on anything that I was going to say. unlike this, you know, tightly controlled podcast we're on now. Huh. But it's good. It's interesting to listen to. It doesn't take a lot of time. And it's actually, I actually enjoy listening to it for the quality of it, for his voice and his delivery, as much as what he actually says. So there you go.
Wow. You know, something else I forgot to mention, one of the things I did pick up at WorldCon, one of the few books I picked up at WorldCon because I went out of my way not to buy things, but I found myself compelled to pick up Ray Guns Over Texas, which was launched at Lone Star Con, edited by Richard Claw, and which features our good friend Derek, as well as Stina Light, and some other people like Michael Moorcock and Lawrence Person and Joe Lansdale and Don Webb, you know, a few, you know, people that have a bit of a reputation. Neil Barry Jr. is in here as well. Very good book, very good collection, very, I don't want to call it lighthearted, but it certainly is a bit more of a celebratory collection than a lot of the anthologies that have been coming out lately. I can only describe it as being an anthology that has really good energy. It really keeps its momentum up throughout the entire job. The only criticism that I have about our friend Derek's story in here, Grey Goo and You, is that it takes place in Lincoln, Nebraska. And it's obviously, the title involves Nano run amok, and having spent as many hours as I did driving through Texas, I really wanted the story to take place in Texas. but it does not.
I hear the roads are really good in there.
Huh?
I hear the roads are really good in Texas.
The roads are good, but the traffic kind of bites. So, yeah, I was underwhelmed. I had always heard epic tales of out-of-state cars having trouble keeping up with the traffic there, and I found that to be patently false. And the only other thing I wanted to mention, the last issue of Asimov's, which I think, as of this recording, is still on the newsstands. Let me check what month that is. I think it's November. I'm not certain. A couple really good stories in there that I enjoyed. Neil Asher has a story in there called Memories of Earth, which was really good. And Paul DeFilippo has a very good story, very funny. Adventures in Cognitive Homogamy, a love story. Which was quite enjoyable. Let me just double check the date on that. Yes, it's the October-November double issue. There was a lot of stuff in there. Also, quite a bit of poetry in this issue as well. Probably the most number of poems I've actually seen in an issue in quite a while, even for the double issues. And the latest issue just showed up on my tablet this week. Which would be the December issue.
Yeah,
oh,
right.
God, it's December already.
Yep.
So that just came out, and I will hopefully get that consumed as well as all the other short stuff that still is piling up around my feet on a regular basis. Have found the short market this year to be a touch pedestrian, which is something we might have talked about in a future podcast. I mean, there's been some really good anthologies that have come out, and there's been some solid stories in them. And I'm actually quite curious as to what the Hugo nominees are going to be next year. We still got a few months to go in this year, so.
Oh, please don't. Don't rush it. Don't rush it.
Yeah, I know. Believe me, I know. My wife just wrote a story for the British website Anorak about how Halloween is now launching earlier and earlier, and how some of the Halloween superstores were popping up in August, and how it seems to be following the footsteps of Christmas as to trying to widen its footprint as much as it possibly can. But it's been this past month, especially most of the short stuff that I read was really good. Which good, hopefully the average for the year is going to skew up, quite a bit. So that's all I got. You gentlemen have anything else?
That was it, I think.
Good. All for me.
We still plan on doing some book centric episodes, in the months to come. And we are going to try to get one done before another month has passed and try to be a regular feature on our beloved SF Signal website. Hugo Award winning SF Signal website, pardon me, 2-time award winning. So until next time, gentlemen, I hope you both have a good evening.
And yep. All, you too. And to all of you as well out there.
Good night.